For those of you that are guests, we're in the middle of our Science and the Bible class here, going through the Scriptures, looking at the scientific content there and helping people get past their barriers to receiving the Bible as your free Word of God. Also looking for opportunities to demonstrate a scientific accuracy and help resolve issues and controversies within the Christian community. Before I do that, though, I thought I'd say a word about that photograph they showed on television last night. I don't know how many of you ever caught that. But it's the first ever photograph of a planet. And, it showed this nice star image, and you saw a little black dot in front of the star. So it's a planet that went across the face of the star. And you want to know how they pulled that off? Well, they used optical interferometry to get that image. The chances of getting more like it aren't very good. They picked a candidate star where they thought they had a good chance of making it happen. And it's a planet about the mass of Jupiter, maybe a little bit bigger, that orbits very closely to its star. It's the one extrasolar planet that astronomers have seen that orbits very close to its star. It's three times closer than Mercury is to our star. So you got this giant planet orbiting very close to its star, which means you got a fairly decent chance of capturing an image of that planet if you've got the technology to image the disk of a star. And now we do have that technology. The Keck telescope on top of Hawaii is a very appropriate instrument for taking those kinds of images. But to do it again, you're going to need another star like Pegasi 51 that's relatively close to us, that's got a big planet, orbiting about its star closer than Mercury orbits our star. And so far, of the 20 extrasolar planets, really only one meets that condition, the one that they got the image of. But they may find some more. To me, what's remarkable about this, it's it really removes the doubt about extrasolar planets. I mean, how they've been finding these planets on other stars, going around other stars, is that they look at the spectrum. They don't actually see the star. They measure the spectrum of the star. And what they notice is that the spectral lines of the star shift back and forth, which tells us that the star is moving closer and farther away from us. It's a Doppler effect. You know, as a train moves towards you, the whistle from that train is a low pitch. A high pitch. As it moves away from you, it's got a low pitch. Same thing happens to light waves. And so they can tell how fast the star is moving relative to us in the line of sight. You know, you're observing here, looking far away, and you can see the thing moving back and forth like that. And what would cause a star to move back and forth in the line of sight? Well, some other massive object going around it. Got a massive object going around it. The gravity from that object will pull a star close when the planet's between you and the star, and when it's on the other side, it will pull. And so that's how they've been picking up these extrasolar planets, and the list today stands at 20. 20 such planets have been found outside of our solar system, and, you know, obviously they're all big, because this technique will only pick up the big planets. You know, if it's a planet like Earth, it's not going to move the star enough for you to detect whether or not it's there. But the uncertainty in all of this is that what you're really measuring are the lower limits to the mass of a planet. And the upper limit can go all the way up to infinity. And here's why. Okay, here's a star, and it's orbiting like this. If it's orbiting in the plane relative to your line of sight, then you get the maximum push and pull from the mass of that planet. But supposing it's orbiting like this, if it's orbiting perpendicular to the line of sight, you're not going to see that star going back and forth at all, regardless of how massive that object might be. And so all you're really getting is a lower limit to the mass of the planet. It could be one Jupiter mass. It could be 10,000 Jupiter masses. Well, if it's 10,000 Jupiter masses, then it's a star. It's not a planet, it's a star. Okay, what makes this special is that they were able to see the image of the planet on the image of the star. What that tells us is it's very nearly in the line of sight relative to us. I mean, if it's like this, you're never going to see the planet superimposed on the star image. You're only going to see it superimposed on the star image if it's orbiting like this, which means that we now have a pretty good estimate of the planet orbiting, the mass of the planet orbiting Pegasi 51, and it indeed is a true planet. We have ruled out that it could be a star, because some astronomers said, hey, all these extrasolar planets that they're finding are simply low-mass stars orbiting another star, and they're orbiting like this, and so we're really seeing stars, and people are thinking that they're planets. But of course, now they've seen 20 of them. It's hard to imagine all 20 are going to be like this. But the fact that they've now seen one image on superimposed on top of the image of the star demonstrates that it really is a planet, although a rather big planet. By the way, all 20 stars on which they've seen planets going around them, the orbits of those planets, the masses of those planets, are not at all like our solar system. Astronomers have never seen a planetary system that is like ours with the capacity to support life. What they're discovering is that our solar system really is the exception. We're the one system that we've discovered so far where you've got the gas giants far away from the star and with stable orbits, and with orbits that do not have high eccentricities. Maybe I need to explain that term. Okay. Thank you for getting this. This is really going to help in more ways than one. Okay. If the planet is going around the star in a nearly circular orbit, that's called a low eccentricity orbit. But as you remember from your elementary school day physics, all the planets go around their stars in elliptical orbits. But an ellipse can be very much like a circle in some situations. But an ellipse could also be like this. And that's what's called a high eccentric orbit, where the planet goes out much farther from the star in one part of its orbit than it does another, where it comes in close. And so astronomers measure what they call the eccentricity, which is simply the ratio of the long distance to the short distance. And what's interesting about our solar system is the eccentricities, except for Pluto, are low. They're down around 1%. But what they're seeing in these other systems is that the eccentricities are high, typically 20%. Now, if they're that high, you can forget about a planet like Earth. Planets like Earth could exist, but they would never exist in a stable enough orbit to support life. And this is what we're seeing. The other thing we're noticing is that it's rare in these other systems for these Jupiter-massed planets to be orbiting far away from their stars. They're orbiting close. Like this one with Pegasi 51, it's three times closer to its star than Mercury is to our star. And that's not always the case. Sometimes they're orbiting out by where Venus is. But hey, if you've got a gas giant orbiting around its star at the orbit of, say, Mercury, Venus, Earth, or Mars, you can, again, forget about planets like Earth with the capacity to support life. In fact, all you got to do is take our planet Jupiter, move it just very slightly closer towards the Sun, and then the Earth would be a dead planet. The reason is that Jupiter is so massive that moving it slightly closer to the Sun means that its gravity will now destabilize the orbit of planet Earth. So we'd be in trouble. Toast is another word, but... so far ours is the only system they discovered yet where the gas giants are small enough and distant enough that it's not going to disturb the orbits of planets like Earth. Yes? Well, Jupiter has 0.1% the mass of our sun. Right. No, no, you're right. That star is going to exert tremendous tidal forces on the planet. But because the planet is not very massive compared to the star, the reverse is not the case. You can look at our Earth-Moon system. The Moon's about 1/80th the mass of the Earth, and we get tides of a few feet of water. But on the Moon, you get tides of 150 feet of rock. So in that case, the Earth is exerting tremendous tidal forces on the Moon, but the reverse isn't necessarily the case. Okay, Greg. Okay, of the 20 planets they have found, the smallest one could be is 1/2 of a Jupiter mass. Now keep in mind, all you're measuring are lower limits to the mass. So the least mass of any one of them could be is 1/2 a Jupiter mass. And the most massive are up around 9 Jupiter masses minimum. And again, the maximum's open-ended. You can go all the way up to infinity. So they could be actually stars. A number of those 20 probably are stars. Oh, I get what you're talking about. Yeah, technically, by some definitions, Jupiter is a star. It's massive enough that it actually throws off heat from gravitational energy. Jupiter is about 3 degrees centigrade warmer than it would be if it had, say, the mass of Earth. So it does throw off a little bit of its own light. But the light it throws off is quite feeble compared to the light it throws off by reflecting sunlight. The sunlight's enough to bring its temperature up around 150 degrees Kelvin, and Jupiter only adds 3 degrees to that. Yes. Gas giants you can call failed stars. Anything that has less than 8% of the sun's mass will never generate nuclear fusion. So if a star has less mass than that, it will never ignite the hydrogen fusion process. And so it will just but it will have some of its own light. Just because of the gravitational energy that it would be releasing as it collapses. And, we do have the capacity to actually see the bigger ones of those failed stars. We call them brown dwarfs. They never get hot enough to become red, but we call them brown dwarfs. They exhibit just a very feeble glow. And Jupiter's in that category, but Jupiter is only, again, 1/10 of 1% the mass of the sun. So it's got 80 times less mass than what's necessary for it to ignite nuclear fusion. But some of these other planets they're discovering are a lot more massive than Jupiter, 9, 10 Jupiter masses. And so they would throw off a little more light. And actually, NASA's got plans to build instruments that would be able to see the light from such planets. As feeble as it is, they'd be able to pick it up. Probably within 10 years, we'll be having direct images of these objects. I mean, the reason why you pick it up as it goes in front of the star is that it doesn't matter what temperature it is, as long as it's a lot colder than the star, it will show up as a black dot. And so that technique, you're going to catch it regardless. But eventually, we'll have instruments that can image the planets independent of the star. Sure. But, I mean, it's an easy technique again. As long as it goes in front of the star, and the star is hot, and the planet's cool, it'll show up as a black dot. And so what they did is they just looked for a black dot. And, indeed, they found one. Okay, question over here? Yes.
Yeah, can they also see, or is this technique much less accurate?
You're not going to pick that up, but this is an object where they've not only imaged the planet as it went in front of the star, they're also able to pick it up. I mean, this is a planet we already knew about. from this other technique, we already knew the planet existed, and they were saying, well, if it orbits that close to its star, and, you know, if it's orbiting in the same line of sight as we are, same plane as our line of sight, then we got a decent possibility it might cross its star and we might be able to image it. That's why they went after it. And indeed, they were lucky and they were able to pick it up. So, but bottom line is this is demonstrating a lot more evidence for the design of our solar system, because before all these planets were discovered, astronomers are speculating that maybe all the planetary systems that we know are out there are going to be kind of like ours. What we're now discovering is, so far, none of them are like ours. And over here? You'd be able to detect Jupiter. Saturn would be a real push. Our current technology probably wouldn't be able to pick up a Saturn, but it could pick up a Jupiter. Yeah, Jupiter's got as much mass as all the rest of the solar systems combined and then some. It's got three times as much mass as all the other planets combined. So it's closer. The closer the gas giant is to the star, the easier it is to pick up. So trying to pick up a Saturn, it's got three times less mass and it's farther away. So yeah, you're probably not going to pick it up. And Uranus, it's even more difficult. Again, the lower the mass, the farther it is away from the star, the more difficult it is to detect the object. So, doing well to pick up a Jupiter. Yes?
When you speak about light, you're talking about emitting rays within the human visual spectrum.
Yeah, when I'm speaking about light, I'm speaking about light that we human beings can detect, which isn't saying much because we can detect everything, all the way from very long radio wavelengths to extreme gamma ray wavelengths. But in this particular case, the image was captured in the visible part of the spectrum. You could do the same technique at the infrared and pick it up there as well, or the ultraviolet. Okay. All right. Oh, one more, and then we'll zip on to our text. Yes. Okay, could I make clear again the distinction between a star and a planet? That's hard to do. It depends which astronomer you talk to. You will get different answers from different astronomers. Definition number one, if it glows with its own light, it's a star. Definition number two, it's only a star if it's burning by nuclear fusion, the hydrogen bond mechanism. Okay, if you go with that definition, that, by the way, is the most common definition that astronomers will use. We don't call it a star unless it's burning by nuclear fusion. In that case, it's got to be at least 8% the mass of our star, the Sun, before that's going to happen. The one exception to that is we also call burnt-out stars stars. A white dwarf star isn't burning by nuclear fusion. It's typically a star bigger than our star, and it's run out of its fuel. But because it was burning so hot, you know, 20,000 degrees Kelvin, 30,000 degrees Kelvin, it can actually be brighter than our star, even though it's not burning by nuclear fusion anymore. It takes a long time for a hot star to cool off. And so we see billions of these white dwarf stars, even though they're not burning by nuclear fusion. But they are bigger than 8% of the mass of the Sun. And so, yeah, probably the most common definition you'll see in astronomy texts, if it's got more than 8% of the mass of the Sun, we call it a star, no matter what kind of energy we see flowing out of the star or where it comes from. As long as it's more than 8%, we'll call it a star. If it's less than 8%, well, some astronomers will still call it a star because technically it still burns, you know, gives off some of its own light. But usually you'll see them qualifying it and say, well, it's really a brown dwarf. And you say, what's the difference between a brown dwarf and a planet? Well, there again, it depends which astronomer you talk to. But typically, if it's less than 10 Jupiter masses, we call it a planet. If it's more than 10 Jupiter masses, we call it a brown dwarf. But technically, Jupiter is a brown dwarf. It's exhibiting its own light. It's just a very small brown dwarf. If it gets small enough, you call it a planet.
Okay, that's clear.
That's all clear? So that's why I couldn't give a clear answer to your question. Yes. Okay, what are the fuel sources for a star? Okay, well, the one we've talked about is hydrogen fusion. Okay, that's where protons come together and make helium. And again, if you remember your high school physics, a helium nucleus weighs a lot less or has less mass than two protons and two neutrons. And the mass difference is energy that's released. That's why a hydrogen bomb is so destructive. Because you start off with hydrogen, you make helium, and the helium isn't as massive as the hydrogen you started with, and that's E equals MC squared. There's your energy release. Well, that's what's happening with the sun. The sun is a continuously exploding hydrogen bomb. And that's where we get our light and heat from, is that mechanism. But when all the hydrogen is gone, then what happens? Well, what happens at that point is the sun will begin to burn helium. When it runs out of hydrogen, it's going to burn helium. And that, by the way, explains why the sun is hotter today than when God first created life on planet Earth. You've heard me say this. The sun is 35% brighter. Okay, let me ask a little physics question here. Why do we get more heat and light out of the sun today than we did 3.86 billion years ago? Yeah. Partly, but that's a tiny part. Okay? Our atmosphere is different. Well, that explains why the temperature on the surface of the Earth stays constant. But why is the sun 35% brighter? Gravity? Hey, guys, it's easier than that. Let me take you to the blackboard.
Got a hand over here?
Yes? More fusion. You got the right answer. Hey,
right.
You can come back to this class anytime you want. That's great.
Somebody over here said cold fusion. That's not the right answer. Hey, this is why you should always take or encourage your children to take geometry. All right, here's the sun. Okay. Where does the fusion? I better take this. All right, thank you.
Okay, where does the fusion in the sun first start? In the center. By the way, why does it first start in the center? More gravity, more pressure, more heat. That's where it's going to start first. Okay? Now then, what happens when the sun burns up all the hydrogen at the center of the star? Okay, yeah, it's going to start burning hydrogen here. Okay, it exhausts all the hydrogen at the center, so that's going to ignite hydrogen out here. And what happens when the hydrogen burning gets out here? Less atmosphere to go through, but the bigger reason is that you've got a larger surface area over which hydrogen fusion is taking place. In other words, the surface area of a small sphere is less than the surface area of a big sphere. And as the sun burns more and more of its hydrogen, the sphere where hydrogen burning takes place gets bigger and bigger. And so that explains why the sun is 35% brighter today than it was in the beginning. Brighter and hotter. Okay. And just as a point of review, how did God handle that for planet Earth? God changed our atmosphere, made the atmosphere less efficient in trapping heat so that the temperature on the surface of the Earth remains constant. Now, how did he do that? How did he change the atmosphere? That's it. God introduced just the right kinds of light, at just the right time and just the right abundances in order to very accurately bring down the efficiency of the Earth's greenhouse effect, its capacity to trap heat, so that as the sun got progressively brighter and brighter and brighter, the Earth's atmosphere got progressively less and less efficient in trapping heat, keeping the temperature of the surface of the Earth constant so that life could survive. Okay, what do non-Christian astrophysicists call this? Anybody remember? What? I'm just seeing if you were listening, because I mentioned this last week. They call it the amazing double coincidence. Okay? The Al Gore effect, all right. Okay. Now then, sometime in the future, 5 billion years from now, this circle is going to reach the surface. All the hydrogen's gone. We will become toast. Actually, we become toast even when it gets out about here. But at this point, okay, when it reaches the surface, then the hydrogen fusion process stops. No longer is the sun going to be burning by fusion, hydrogen fusion. And when it stops, nothing is there to stop gravity. Because what's going on in a star is radiation is forcing the star to get bigger. Gravity is forcing the star to get smaller. Okay, when you run out of hydrogen, this gets stopped. And so then gravity is going to collapse the sun. So the sun is going to get smaller as gravity pushes it down. And what happens when gravity pushes it down to the temperature at the center? It heats up. So it's going to get a lot hotter at the center of our star when it runs out of hydrogen fuel. It'll get hot enough to ignite helium fusion. Okay, what's helium fusion? This is when helium atoms are forced together to make things like carbon, oxygen, magnesium, all the way up to iron. And by the way, this helium fusion process runs a lot faster than hydrogen fusion. In fact, astronomers call this the helium flash because it runs so much faster than hydrogen fusion. So it gets very, very hot. And that means that we now have radiation much stronger than gravity. So what's going to happen to the sun? It's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. It'll get big enough to include the orbit of planet Earth. So during the helium flash phase, the sun will get bright enough to actually incinerate the Earth. It'll encompass the Earth. The Earth will be inside the outer part of the sun. Okay, now what happens when it gobbles up all of its helium fuel? Okay, if it's a really big star, it goes supernova. That means if it's 1.4 times the mass of our star, the sun, it will go supernova. You say, well, that's not a very big star. Well, the problem is stars lose mass as they age. And so a star that's three times the mass of our star, the sun, when it's born, will not have 1.4 solar masses by the time it goes through all of this, and it will not go supernova. But a star that's bigger than that, say five solar masses when it's born, will still have enough mass when this is all over that it will go supernova. And what happens when it goes supernova? Gravity squishes the star so much that it undergoes one final catastrophic eruption where it makes stuff like iron, uranium, thorium, and all that kind of good stuff, and actually outshines 100 billion other stars for a few months' duration. Okay, but that's not going to happen to the sun. When it runs out of its helium fuel, it will shut down, and then it becomes a white dwarf, and it will simply cool off until it goes totally black. So how long does that take? Quite a few billions of years to cool off. It's kind of like what happens when you burn a log on an open fire. The log takes what? Maybe 2 hours to burn? How long does it take for the ashes of that burnt log to become black? It takes all night. Yeah, it takes, what, 8-9 hours for it to go. So actually, the cooling off phase is longer than the burning phase. And that's true of these white dwarf stars. We see them because they're still in that long process of cooling off. If they shut down their burning 3 billion years ago, they're still hot enough for us to see them today. Yeah, Kathy? Okay. I've noticed that. They've never called a car a supernova. We have a nova, but they've never come up with that name yet. Maybe you should register that trademark and make some money off that. Anyway. Yeah, a nova is a star that's not massive enough to go supernova. That's obvious, okay. But typically, you know, the most common nova is this. You've got this white dwarf star. I better start over again here. Okay, we got this white dwarf star here. But orbiting it is another star. But the white dwarf is more massive than its partner star. And the partner star is close enough to the white dwarf star that it's pulling mass in. It gets a fresh infusion of hydrogen gas. And this is what causes it to flare up and become a nova. And sometimes it burns it all very quickly. Sometimes it gets repeated infusions. So it steals a whole bunch and goes nova, and then a few years later, it can go nova again. That's why we've made the suggestion in one of our papers that the Christmas star can't be a supernova, but it might be a nova. Because what does it tell us in the text? The star flared up twice, separated by about a year and a half. And that would fit the description of a nova. A supernova wouldn't count. Another reason why it can't be a supernova was a supernova, everybody would have seen it. And only the wise men seem to be aware of this event. Yes? Oh, no, sorry, I didn't give you the whole phase. During the helium burning phase, the star gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. When it runs out of helium, you no longer got any radiation coming out from the star. That shuts down, so gravity becomes the bully, and gravity will squish it down. And that makes it a white dwarf. No, no, no. Okay, let me review it again. During the hydrogen burning phase, the sun does get bigger and bigger and bigger, slowly, because you've got more and more radiation coming out from hydrogen burning as the hydrogen burning phase goes from the center out to the surface. But when it runs out of hydrogen fuel, then gravity will squish it down. But eventually gravity squishes enough that it ignites the helium burning phase, and then this star gets bigger and bigger. And when it runs out of helium, then that will shut down and gravity will squish it down, and if it doesn't have more than 1.4 solar masses, it will squish it down and it will become a white dwarf, and as a white dwarf, it will end its life. It will just simply cool off until it becomes a black ember. Okay? So there's two shrinking phases. It shrinks after hydrogen burning stops, and it shrinks after helium burning stops. Yes, March. Is that called the red giant phase is when a star is undergoing a helium burning. And by the way, when I made the term helium flash, it's the bigger stars that go through that flash phase. The smaller stars will go through it more slowly. So there's different kinds of red giants. But when you look at Betelgeuse and Orion tonight, that's a red giant star. And by the way, it's big enough that it will go supernova. So it's going to have a supernova phase one of these days. So I wouldn't make any plans anytime after Betelgeuse goes supernova. Yes. OK. Okay, are black holes caused by really massive stars after they're dead? Yes. Only supernova can wind up as neutron stars or black holes. Any star less massive than that will never become a neutron star or black hole. So what's the difference between a neutron star and a black hole? Mass. The more massive neutron stars will become black holes. If they're less, they will end their life as simply a neutron star. Yes. Okay, the new heavens and the new earth, it's not stellar physics. I'm not looking for stars in the new creation. One of the ways you can demonstrate that conclusively is the Revelation chapters 21 and 22 tell us there's no gravity, there's no thermodynamics, there's no electromagnetism. You need all three to have stars. Take away any one of those three, stars become impossible. So, yeah, it's one of the things I've got to console myself about as an astronomer. In the new creation, there will be no stars. Yes. Okay. Yeah, people looked at Revelation 16:8 and said, is that the Bible prophesying that the sun will enter a helium-burning phase and incinerate all of us? I personally don't think so. Why? Because that's 5 billion years off in the future. Yeah, I think it's an atmospheric effect. Yeah, if you change the atmosphere of the Earth, it will have the effect of causing the sun to scorch people with its heat. And so if we begin to trap more heat in our atmosphere, and indeed we're doing that, because we're burning up so many fossil fuels and knocking down so many forests, we're raising the efficiency of our atmosphere to trap heat at the very time when the sun's getting hotter. So, by the way, the effect of the sun getting hotter really isn't that significant on a year-to-year basis. You have to wait a few million years before you can measure it. But the other effect is not. In just a few decades, we've significantly increased the capacity of our atmosphere to trap heat. Yes. Could solar flare activity account for that? No. Solar flare activity can mess up our radio communication. It can cause more X-ray damage of our ozone shield. It can do things like that. But as far as a significant heat source, no, it's not. Even the most drastic solar flare is not a significant source of heat. But hey, if it begins to damage our ozone shield, that could have other consequences. Yes?
When you look at the sun, it appears to be a certain size, and we know it's 800,000 miles across or something. But how do we know where within that the smaller burning surface is?
Yes, we do. Astronomers know exactly where the hydrogen fusion is taking place in our star, the sun. All you got to know is the mass of the star and the age of the star. You know the age of the sun and the mass of the sun, then you know exactly where the hydrogen burning is taking place. I mean, that's a standard problem we give our astronomy freshman students to figure out. So, you know, we give them the mass and
now, what happens
is that spot where hydrogen fusion or that surface of a sphere where hydrogen fusion is taking place, that's got to percolate through all the gas layers above. And so what it does is that progressively heats up all the layers of the sun that are above that burning zone. And that's why when you look at the sun, it looks like all the heat's coming from the surface. Well, the source is really closer to the core. By the time it makes it to the surface, it heats it up to about 5,800 degrees centigrade, and that's what we see. So, yes.
And I just experienced something that might be related to that, but I'm very much disappointed. absolutely blind. And I've been going without sunglasses most of my life. And I've seen a lot of bright places. And my son said he thought it was
well, possibly. Even the south tip of South Africa isn't that far south. I mean, it is true that the thinning of the ozone shield is most significant in Antarctica. This is where they call it the ozone hole. And the ozone hole has been getting bigger and bigger as each year goes by. And sometimes the hole gets big enough where it gets up to around 40 degrees south latitude. So yeah, if you're in the south tip of New Zealand, yeah, you might be able to experience some of the effects of that. Southern tip of South Africa, you're still farther north than 40 degrees south. And really, the impact is down around 60 degrees and 70 degrees south. But maybe due to the fact that there's just a lot less air pollution there. That may have a big effect. I mean, here you are living in Los Angeles. You get used to the fact that... The sun gets filtered a bit, yes?
Are the fluctuations, have they not been occurring for eons?
Well, what we're seeing with the ozone layer is that it's not so much a fluctuation. I mean, the problem is that you get people saying, oh, this global warming thing, we really don't know. It's complicated. By the way, that is getting sorted out. There is a global warming effect. It's just not as big as what some people thought it was. But because of the complexity of global warming, a lot of people think likewise the ozone problem is anybody's guess. That's not true. The ozone problem is much simpler than global warming. And we got much more accurate measurements. And also it's not as subject to the fluctuations of global warming, from other effects like the orbital characteristics of the Earth. In the case of the ozone shield, we've been watching it progressively get thinner and thinner since the early 1950s. And as it's been getting thinner and thinner, we've been observing human skin cancer rates going up, and the rate at which the human skin cancer rates are going up are entirely consistent with a decrease in the ozone shield. Now, the effect is biggest in Antarctica, but we also see it in the Arctic. The effect is least in the tropics. So people living in the tropics, it's very difficult to say that the ozone protection is any different than what it was 40 years ago. But if you're living in high latitudes, there's no question that there's been a significant thinning of the ozone shield that's been having its consequences on us.
What I'm driving at was, is there any evidence for there having been a thinning of the ozone shield since the 50s?
Yes. If you go back to the Vela supernova, you got a place where the ozone shield was significantly thinned. Supernovas really mess up our ozone shield. So, again, you don't want to be around when Betelgeuse goes supernova. Incidentally, it's going to go supernova anytime in the next 10,000 years. So, you know, there are people who take out life insurance for things that are a lot less risky than that, but... I'm not sure the insurance company is going to be able to pay off, so I wouldn't advise taking out the insurance. So, yes. Well, that's kind of what's interesting, is that human industrial activity increases the ozone quantity in the troposphere and drops it in the stratosphere. So the stratospheric ozone is getting thinner and thinner and thinner. Tropospheric ozone is getting thicker and thicker. But, hey, most of it's in the stratosphere. And so the fact that that's becoming significantly thinner, that's the real thing to worry about. But if you're living in a big city where you've got a lot of bromine being released and chlorine products, then this what does is cause respiratory problems, and a lot of that's because there's too much ozone. So, by the way, you do need ozone in the troposphere. Without ozone in the troposphere, you've got nothing to cleanse the atmosphere of pollutants released by trees. Now, trees are nasty pollutants, but thanks to the fact that there's ozone in the troposphere, that gets taken care of. But too much ozone, that will cause problems. We wrote an article on this in Facts and Faith. I was going to try to jump into our lesson a little bit here. I don't have a lot of time to do that, but let's get going, okay? Let's see if we can get something done here. We've been trying to get through this list of why the flood of Genesis though universal, is not global. And let me see if I can zing through a few more before we run out of time here. These are the ones we've already covered. The argument that throughout the Bible, that just because you've got phrases like the entire face of the earth doesn't mean that it's global. Mountains that lie beyond. So even in the text, we got a demonstration that universality doesn't necessarily equal globality. The limited extent of sin, the principle here is God's judgment wrath only extends as far as the limits of human reprobation, and very obviously, human beings have not settled Antarctica. Human beings have not settled Antarctica. No need to flood Antarctica. And there's really no need for Noah to take on board a couple of emperor penguins. Limited water supply, the planet simply lacks the water to produce a global flood. That's significant because Genesis 7 tells us all the water came from earthbound sources. And those earthbound sources are not enough for a global flood. And trying to claim that the earth was very smooth before the flood and all the mountains were built and ocean basins were made during the receding of the waters, that doesn't work because if we had that much tectonics going on, we'd know about it. Trying to explain 6,000 miles of continental drift in an 11-month time span, there's no way you're going to hide that from geophysicists today. And if that much stuff was going on, nobody would survive. The ark wouldn't survive. It'd be nothing but splinters. And we all know the effects of 2 inches of plate tectonics. Try 6,000 miles of plate tectonics. Then we have the text saying that the human race had failed to fill the earth. That's a strong indication that human beings were not global because God is judging them for their failure to spread out and fill the earth. The text excludes the lower animals. Only birds and mammals are dealt with in the text. We pointed that out. You look up all the Hebrew words in Genesis 6, 7, 8, and 9 for the animals that went on board the ark, and nothing there compels us to take it beyond birds and mammals. Good reason, because those are the only animals that can be negatively impacted by human sin. Sinning in front of the bacteria in your body really doesn't change the behavior of the bacteria or the ants that run around your house. Number 7, as we go through the first 9 chapters of Genesis, we notice there are no geographical place names beyond Greater Mesopotamia. When you get to Genesis 10, suddenly the Bible becomes global in its geography. Previous to Genesis 9, it's limited. Last week we dealt with these two. Genesis 7:19 does not require the water to cover all the land masses of planet Earth. When it says the waters covered the mountains to a height of 15 cubits, we need to realize the word for mountains also means hills. It means any elevation above the plain. Could be a little mound of garbage in your backyard all the way up to Mount Everest. Anything like that would be included. The word for cover could mean that the water permanently resided, the water ran over, or the water fell upon as rain. All three, we noted, is enough to destroy the entire human race. And then we ended on this one. Genesis 8:4 does not require the ark to land on Mount Ararat. One of the big myths of our day is that Noah's ark came to rest on Mount Ararat. What does the Bible tell us where the ark came to rest? Just mountains. Hey, you're all listening last week. That's great. Came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. What are the mountains of Ararat? It covers everything from foothills to hills to lower mountains to the high peaks of the Ararat range. Okay, what is the extent of the Ararat range? Yeah, we mentioned it's about 100 to 150,000 square miles. Today, we find the mountains of Ararat in Russia, in Iran, in Turkey, and Iraq. So it covers a rather large area. And we showed you this map last week that indicates that one portion of these mountains of Ararat actually comes all the way down to the Mesopotamian floodplain. Just north of the ancient city of Nineveh, you can see the mountains of Ararat. So the ark could have quite well have come to rest there rather than some other place. Okay, in a few minutes, let's see if we can at least get through number 10. The ark is too fragile for a flood made global in just 40 days. What does the text tell us that the ark was made of? Gopher wood. Okay. Wood. Wood can only withstand so much stress. Even the strongest timbers, and we've noted that the ark was made out of oak, probably wouldn't have been strong enough. So it was made from timbers that were stronger than oak. Such timbers were available to Noah. But even timbers of that nature are not going to withstand 6,000 miles of plate tectonics in just a few months, let alone the waters rushing up to the height of Mount Everest, or the waters rushing down to the Marianas Trench, 38,000 feet down. You have all that activity taking place within 40 days, waters coming down and making the flood global, or the 11 months thereafter, and the ark is simply not going to survive. That's putting it mildly. We'd probably have difficulty finding tiny slivers of the Ark of Noah if it was subjected to global flood dynamics. You'd have trouble finding tiny slivers of human flesh of the body of Noah if indeed the Ark was subjected to these global dynamics. Yes. Well, I'm saying if the flood was really global, then you've got a lot of water running at high velocities. And if you've got 6,000 miles of plate tectonics taking place in the crust below the water, this is going to generate tidal waves of enormous height. Okay, say how high? We're talking thousands of feet high, moving at the velocity of sound. Okay? Now I think you get the image of the ark being shattered into little tiny slivers, of the human beings on board the ark also being shattered into little tiny slivers. Keep in mind, an earthquake that's only magnitude 9 is strong enough to shake the bark off trees. That's just a magnitude 9 earthquake. And this is orders of magnitude greater than that. So my whole point is the ark simply, the way the Bible describes the construction of the ark, there's no way it would survive that kind of catastrophic water activity. Yeah, there was a hand over here I missed. No? Close. I need to close. Yes. All right. Thank you, Tom. Didn't say close. Okay. Preview what we're going to get to next week. Okay? Global flood would not recede so fast. We're going to talk about the olive leaves. Okay? There's an olive tree there. Olive leaves that could be plucked. And then we got the problem that if you're really trying to build in this global flood scenario of Noah rescuing all life on planet Earth, hey, the fossil record testifies to a billion different species. And the planet can only support a few million at one time. By the way, you know what's interesting? If any planet that we can possibly conceive of, there is no possibility of making a planet that can sustain more than 40 million species of life at one time. Our planet is right at the maximum. It's supporting the greatest number of species at a given time that the laws of physics would ever permit for any possible planet to sustain life. We're at the very top. And so going past that top just isn't feasible. And we got 17, but I think I'll just stop with this. We're going to look at the biodeposit problem, the petroleum problem, and probably one of the more significant ones. You're not going to evolve the animals fast enough after the flood to explain the millions of species we have on the planet today. Okay? Let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you that you have been quite clear in your word about the dynamics of the flood, the extent of the flood, the characteristics of the flood. And Lord, it's wonderful that we're living in a time when this is such a controversial passage of Scripture, when almost everybody on the planet, whether they be atheist, agnostic, or deist, or Christian, loves to talk and argue about the Genesis flood. So Lord, I pray that you would use that open door of interest and curiosity and debate and incriminate to enable us to communicate your truth, life, and love in such a manner that through the power of the Holy Spirit, people would come to faith in Jesus Christ. And Christians would come to resolution on this issue and begin to move forward to bring the lost into your kingdom. In Jesus' name, amen.